After all this, you still...
I still want that gas, yes. And you had better deliver.
Hey again, dear listener. Welcome back to The Greenhouse. It's me, Adi. And joining me today for part three of the Piss series, I have Gabby.
Hi.
And Jeff.
Hello.
So, Jeff, I also got to send you that challenge coin at some point. This is your third appearance. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
And where last we left off in our series, we discussed the fixation on identity in the first part, and then we started to inch towards power in the second part when we talked about the establishment. And today, I really wanted to delve into power itself and really how our understanding of history has it in more oblique terms. And at least in my estimation, it's not understood as much in the foreground. I think it's something that gets ignored when we talk about politics, society, and whatnot. So I figured, having Gabby and Jeff on with your backgrounds in history somewhat, I figured this would be a good place for you guys to start. So I wanted to start actually with your background specifically. So we'll start with you, Gabby. What's your area of expertise when it comes to history?
Okay, so I'll guess I'll work backwards. I just recently got my Master's of Public Administration, so and I concentrated in nonprofit management, which delves a little bit into history. We did some history related to the public administration field. So some of that was part of my master's program, but then my undergraduate, I got a degree in history. So my undergraduate degree is in history. I didn't specialize in something, one area totally, but I found myself gravitating toward classes with that focused in Cold War. I did some stuff in reference to Cold War Latin America. There was some stuff I had learned a lot about. So I'm by no means an expert in these areas. However, that was what I ended up gravitating toward due to the professors in my program and what sounded interesting to me when I was an undergrad.
I'll field the same question to you, Jeff.
Hi. So let's see here. I'll work forwards instead of backwards. I got the history pun there. I started actually originally going for medicine, specifically physical therapy technician. And I had a moment in life where I didn't really want to do that exactly, so I switched over to history, just out of my sheer interest in it. And also went in for anthropology. Eventually, I decided to get a history minor and anthropology major. And I mainly focus on... I would say the Near and Far East, ancient societies, etc., namely the classical and medieval.
Gotcha. So I think, like, as a group, we do enjoy talking about social structures and history and things like that. So I think it's worth mentioning, for what it's worth, we aren't inherently qualified to talk hard facts on history. And if you've been coming to this show as like a strict educational program, I'm really sorry, but you can't cite us. We are more so trying to have a meta discussion about the discussion, about the discussion, about politics, history, society, what have you. So I think let's just start with the big question up front, and we can... Because it's such a large topic, I think I'm okay with this taking a bit of a natural turn. Let's just start. What's power? What do you guys define it as? And what seems to be the problem in how people approach it or don't seem to approach it, in your opinions? So, Jeff, Gabby, either of you can start.
Yeah, I thought a little bit about this one. And every time I tried to come up with a definition of power, I hit another wall, because like you said, it is such a huge topic area and there's so many ways you can look at it. And I think it's really important to acknowledge that power is very contingent on the space you're in at the time. It's very relative. It shifts and takes on new meanings depending on the valuation that people put in a society on different things. So I think it's inherently tied to conversations about valuation, what's more important, what we collectively value, not necessarily individually, and how that plays out in the real world and who holds. So whatever we do value, whoever holds that tends to be the person who holds a level of power, which is a very elusive definition, but I don't think there's a way to define it that would be concrete and actually do justice to the various like cultures and groups of people that have defined power in different ways and how it's functioned in their societies. So, but that being said, the other part of the question related to, you know, refresh my memory on that. Sorry.
Oh, just like, what seems to be the problem in how people talk about it or don't talk about it?
Oh, well, that leads in perfectly because I think it is this ill-defined way of talking about power and the lack of a concrete definition. That's at least one facet of why we don't have an understanding of it or not a shared understanding of it, because it is so tied to valuation. If I value one thing and Audie values another, and we're trying to have a conversation about what's better to have and who has more power based on that, it can be really muddy. And so I think people have a tendency to try to avoid talking about it, or they tend to get in a disagreement about what that really looks like and how it's functioned in society up until this point, or maybe downgrading the amount of power one group has had or upplaying the power another group has had, depending on what side you're on. So I think, again, a very wide, broad net definition, but that's what I'm going to go with, and I can punt over to Jeff for his thoughts.
Good luck following that up, Jeff.
I actually concur with that quite a bit. And I also think that I think that there is also a level of, you know, individual power, what you can do on your own level. There is an assumed power, and there's also real power. The assumption that you have power over others is how much you can, how much one or a group can, like, project their will onto others. As they say about language, it's a dialect with an army and a navy. It doesn't also have to be with this, of course. Power can be various things. Power is just a tool of how you get to where you are, in any given respect, I suppose. And that can come with some costs.
So, Gabby, you just mentioned in the chat that you were thinking about informal power structures, and I think we can definitely dip into that. I think broadly, though, I think we all agree that the most useful way to look at power is something as a consequence of a hierarchy or something used to justify a hierarchy. And informal power is probably one of those ways that you can uphold that, right?
Yeah, I definitely say that. I think informal power structures are incredibly interesting. And I think Jeff mentioning the personal in that conversation, your perceived level of power, mm-hmm. is really important to that conversation. Because there are structures and authorities. I mean, you can have authority vested in you, which is an official kind of power, I suppose. But there are informal powers that exist and are just as salient, if not more. It's kind of like when you've worked in, if you're working in a job, right? Your boss, your manager might have the most authority and actual power. However, there might be someone who works under them who has a lot of informal power and actually influences the way the office functions or workplace functions.
Like the cool employee type deal?
Yeah, it's kind of like that. I've worked in jobs before where one person quits and you know that a bunch of other people will quit following them because they're just that person that holds that kind of influence that people right. want to follow. And they don't have any formalized power, but that is a form of power that should also be acknowledged, because it's something I think we don't talk about because it's harder to grasp onto, like even more than official power. It's very hard to grasp onto that concept.
Right. And just because like there's so many synonyms for these kinds of things, like someone could look at that and say, well, isn't that charisma? And then charisma ties into that. Then there's also just rhetoric and all of that stuff.
Go ahead.
You're fine.
There's actually, that ties into, and people might be familiar with this, but types of leadership styles. So forgive me if I butcher this, but there is a charismatic leader where they garner a lot of their power and authority based on their charisma. Whereas you have leaders who have rational, I'm not going to be able to remember the exact term, but people who have vested power in them that are backed by a law or an authority, and which ones are most, which ones are best for having a stabilized movement or stabilized society, is a big conversation that happens, because mm-hmm. charismatic leaders are very important to making things move forward. However, if they don't have any official power, they can be de-seated very quickly if they are, they fall out of favor with the people that might have vested power, which, not to tangent, but mm-hmm. I think this kind of ties into a discussion related to history, because I firmly believe that power is also vested in people by others.
Right.
If other people don't buy into your power, you oftentimes do not have it, or there's a high likelihood you could get de-seated from your space of power, even if you hold a lot of resources, which is another way we can understand power. If you piss off enough people at the masses, eventually there will be a boiling point. We've seen that habitually happen in historical events.
Right, and that's kind of one of the core basic ideas in more materialist and particularly left-wing thinking, right? That the people who exist at the bottom of the hierarchy take on the most oppression, however you choose to define that, and because of their sheer number have a power against the hegemony they live under. And that's the theory for change and so on and so forth. And I think more materialist traditions, say, for instance, Marxism, right, I think are more accurate and more correctly, in my opinion, focused on power dynamics in ways that I don't think we discuss at present. And you don't have to necessarily adopt a hard socialist framing to talk about power more correctly, right? But I think, and this is just my read, so you guys can push into this, but the read I seem to get these days when people talk about societal woes or when they're talking politics, they specifically seem to be more focused on individual characters and virtue far more than which of those people hold power, how they exercise it, and to what ends they seem to exercise it. And at least in my estimation, the people who I like to hear from the most on these topics are the ones who are more focused on describing those networks. So what do you guys take of that?
Sure. I think that you are mainly correct about it, because if I just kind of think it, more people are much more focused on the how they present themselves, how they speak, how they talk, how they specific qualities of an individual stand out and talked about more than specifically just how about they get around. And I do definitely agree with that. Like, for instance, when Mitt Romney was running, everybody was talking about, oh, but look how charismatic he is, you know, forget some certain level of who he worked with, you know, Bain. I believe it, what was it?
Bain Capital, yeah.
Yep. And, you know, all the shady stuff that was happening with that and basically what it functions as. And I would bring that up, or, you know, what he has done in the past, and it's more like an argument of, but look how, you know, friendly he is, how much politics he has, you know, it definitely covers up a lot.
Yeah, I think that I'm going to push back a little bit.
That's perfectly fine.
There's also a piece of me that I've seen a lot of conversation around understanding those pieces of power, and I think this is where a lot of conversations come in about retroactively looking back on history and reframing it, and understanding the importance of framing to understand power. The way that power functions, we look back on this stuff, and I think we've seen a lot of conversation recently around how people frame history and how they frame it with a framing of power specifically, and how that's played into the way we've defined things and how we've viewed things up until this point. I think it's a really recent phenomenon, but I'm seeing more and more this power becoming more of a conversation, especially relating to history. I do also see a lot of people adopting the framing of power in their everyday lives and conversations. And it's almost interesting because it feels like too far of a swing in the opposite direction. So I've seen conversations where people make claims about, and this is going to come like out of left field, but like power dynamics and relationships, like individual, like romantic relationships, and how age plays into that.
Mm-hmm.
And making the case that if one partner is, say, 26 and the other one's 20, there is a power dynamic there that's inappropriate because the 26-year-old has more knowledge and is wiser and therefore like has a level of power over the 20-year-old. And while that like is, I guess, kind of true if you're gauging power in terms of what, like, wisdom or something you might know, it also feels like too far of a reach to say that that becomes an immoral relationship because there's a perceived power dynamic shift or complication. So I think there's an awareness of this, but I think it gets muddied very quickly.
I agree with that, because I see this kind of behavior more so in discussions about more so like social liberal circles, especially pertaining to situations between individuals. So you brought up an age gap in two people who are dating, right? And if we don't fully understand the circumstances of it, we can't fully describe the power dynamic therein, right? I think this is an example I've been thinking about, and it's not to discount all the work that happened during this period. I think it was just a difficult time to understand because of the pandemic, because of so many other extenuating factors. Like I'm talking about last year's wave of protests for BLM after the shooting of George Floyd. I think what ends up happening is either people do talk about power or people see an imbalance of power but use an existing framework of virtue to describe it, right? So, I mean, we can talk about how the American police system is a monopoly of violence against its citizenry. I think that's the hard structural way to analyze what police brutality is that one party really has a monopoly of violence and can exercise it on the population. And since it's at will, we can say that then factors of racism, personal bigotry, meeting quotas, all of that stacks up, right? And then what it gets turned into, or at least some of the responses to it that I didn't like, were ones about ending racism as a personal sin. And even though, like, I agree, that's something we have to stop as a society, the hard critique of how the police act, what forms of violence they inflict on people, certain discussions did come up in more radical circles of like, do the police exist to mostly protect wealthier people in urban areas? Yeah, those were more useful discussions to have, but they get watered down. And I think in the discussion you've brought up, right, I think regardless of what someone's opinions are on age differences in dating, right, I think a lot of people bring up certain personal grievances in their lives towards people on the internet, people who may be traumatized by partners, project something onto someone they see on the internet. And, you know, if someone was in a position where that happened to them and then they talk about it to someone else, like that's exactly going to happen, not understanding the dynamics of the relationship. I totally get where you're coming from in that case. So that's one conflation that happens. But for what it's worth, I should also mention that this happens in highly online circles.
Yeah, I think something actually interesting I was thinking of while you were bringing this up. So there's this theory in relation to like nonprofit donor research.
Right.
Very niche thing, right? But it's about how when you have an issue that's so big, people stop caring about it because they can't. It's almost like they feel like they're a drop in the bucket. So the biggest example for this would be like climate change. Like a lot of people think they need to do something about climate change, but it's such a big issue that they feel like they can't affect, that they just stop caring about it, like empathetically, because they just physically cannot. And or there's more research about it, but like that's kind of the working theory, is that you just can't care about something that big. very well. I think this kind of plays into that power dynamic conversation, because it's a lot easier to look at the murder of George Floyd and to say, it was racism in the police department. It was this individualized thing. It was this kind of smaller piece. And when you break it up and you pull back and you say, no, it's a pattern of behavior based on power dynamics, and not just the police departments, but also the way the justice system functions. If you pull this back, it is entirely a system based on how much monetary resources you have, how much influence you have, and that impacts your freedom, is another completely power-based system. And I think saying that and framing it that way makes it feel so much more helpless, because just saying, get rid of the racists out of the police department and the justice system feels a lot more manageable and personal than this whole system is predicated on this kind of twisted power dynamic that is really hard to undo and really hard to fix. So I guess maybe this might be a little more charitable to people, but there is a tendency to kind of run away from these topic areas that feel too big. And I think power permeating every single facet of our life is like one of those areas where we see this happen a lot.
I agree. And I think that's where we ultimately end up in situations where I think where a lot of these highly online or even sometimes in-person discussions often devolve into is trying to understand the personal virtues or lack thereof a person possesses. You know what I mean? So it's like, is person X a racist? Maybe he is, maybe he isn't. But is he just like a yokel spouting it on the internet and that's still wrong? Or is he like the mayor of a city and that informs his policy in that city? Those are two very different things.
Yeah, I definitely agree. If you want to give Jeff a minute, if you wanted to step in at all, then want to take up too much space.
No, that's fine. I feel like I went off a little hard.
Oh, I was just listening. Don't worry. I was enjoying it.
But I definitely agree, Adi. I think it's very important to be mindful of power and what kind of power people have. And I do think, getting back to the roots of what we were talking about, I do think that there is a little more awareness of that recently in conversations that I've at least seen, where people are acknowledging that, you know, if you have a following of, you know, hundreds of thousands of people or millions of people, or you have a lot of monetary resources, you do have a little bit more responsibility because you do leverage a lot more power than other people. Because ultimately, whether we like it or not, if the people who hold power are able to, and we've seen historically, bring about a lot more problems or issues, or are able to change a lot more than the people on the bottom.
With great power comes great responsibility. That's what we're
literally
getting at.
It's Spider-Man.
It's literally Spider-Man, guys.
Everything goes back to Spider-Man.
No, it doesn't, but also
Spider-Man. Oh, wonderful. I will have to agree. And I also think that there is a kind of, regardless if somebody believes it or not, I think that another thing that really takes hold in society is the idea of, even if one doesn't believe in it, is the thought of might makes right. The idea that, and it's not just, you know, I beat you, yada, 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 and warfare, God was on my side and all that. Successful people, those who have power, they got it somehow. And sometimes a lot of people feel left in the dark on just how. And so therefore they just kind of automatically say, well, rich people are successful because they got to where they are. So what they're doing must be right.
The whole prosperity gospel and whatnot.
Right. It's the same thing with, you know, hierarchies just kind of in general. Well, they've always been around for years, their family or this government system. How would we? Do we even want to, you know, remove it from seat? Is that even a viable option? Or they've always been around, so they must be right.
Well, Jeff, this is where I think the anthropological perspective you have, I think, is important. Let's get to maybe the root of the issue now. Like, how did hierarchies arise in human society, and why were they useful?
You know, they're definitely quite useful. It's a I would say it's a easier way to manage resources on just quite a large swath of property and land. The ability to centralize resources really definitely helps. Obtaining that power and able to divvy it up amongst those underneath you, it's much easier to do that than much easier to do that than thinking of a really complex system from the bottom up and making sure that all works. Jared Diamond made a wonderful article, which I'm going to keep talking about until the day I die, because Jared Diamond's still useful, despite agriculture not being the first thing we did. But agriculture, as Jared Diamond says, is the worst mistake in human history, and it is because of creation of hierarchy and the division of labor comes from the creation of agriculture, people needing to man the fields and somebody to supervise those fields creates for a natural state of hierarchy, unfortunately. And not saying that there has never been a society without power. There's always been, as they call big man, big woman, societies focused around some kind of central leader. But that usually was more so about wisdom or age in an egalitarian setting than it is, than it is the dividing of power and, having women, work from the house because they're always walking around carrying kids if it's not a growing season. And you really do see this taking hold and the structure of city governments, at the very least city-state governments, right out of the Neolithic age. And that's kind of when a lot of things start going downhill, as the anarcho-syndicalist I am will say, it's inheritance in the system.
Oh, gosh. Well, so here's the hard question. Are social orders doomed to have an unfair level of inequality in them? Or is it the kind of thing that you can consciously force out of it?
I'm a little bit of a pessimist on that.
I mean, it's fine.
I was hoping for Gabby to say something positive.
Usually I can be a little bit of an optimist, but I think kind of when I was listening to Jeff talk, which fantastic summation of things, Jeff, like could not have done that. So thank you. But I really think it made me think back too, to even family structures always have some form of hierarchy in them. They have some form of people heir to this person or that person, or even cultures that didn't have to do with resource division. It was about who has the most wisdom. So if you think of wisdom as a resource, that gives you more power, right? And I feel like these social structures just kind of are baked into how we interact with each other. We're a social species, we behave in a very social way, and I think the only way to get away from that devolving into some form of, I guess, hierarchical structure where one person has more power and might kind of push that down on other people, we would have to just not live with others, which we really hate doing, right? We love
people. That seems worse.
Yeah. So I feel like, I guess to me, it's like a necessary evil. Like, as much as there will be people who won't, I guess, use this power in a negative way, there are always going to be a handful of people that will. And pessimistic take, but here it is.
Yeah, I mean, go ahead, Jeff.
I said we're all just Sisyphus pushing up a boulder up down in Hades.
See, that's where I'm kind of not at, in that, like, I am very pessimistic about where we are in the present, and definitely reading about the past can be depressing a lot of the times, right? But I still, like, even in my most pessimistic state, I don't believe that the conditions are fully set at times. It's just one of those things about, has something about the human formulation been wrong until this point? or is there just a formulation we haven't tried yet? And on the one hand, like, what seems to be coming up and what Gabby explained is that one way you could justify those hierarchies is if you could justify that the people at the top then have a responsibility to do it justly and take into account certain considerations. And that's really the, I guess, the emotional basis behind democracy, right? Is that, you know, at least the people who you put in charge, you know, they, you had a say in them being in charge, or at least you can trust them to do the right thing, yada, yada. But I think it maybe just comes down to the fact that power just exists in different forms in our society, like beyond just the explicit political power of ruling people. And it's more of a question of how do we make sure that more and more people don't get put at the bottom ends of that pyramid. And that's a tough question to answer for everyone involved. And I'm a baby when it comes to reading theory. I need to read more books. I need to, you know, really get off of these podcasts, like listen to mine. But, you know, I need to definitely like do a little more investigation and listen to people who are smarter than me on this. But I don't fully think we're at the point where this is, you know, I don't think that the Fukuyama conclusion that this is the end of history is necessarily the correct one. It makes sense if you buy the idea that, yes, this is the current hegemony we live under, but it could topple for whatever reason. So let's maybe go back further in time, or maybe forward in time for this method, for this metaphor.
It's kind of hard to go back further.
What historical eras, in your estimation, mirror the one we're in the most? Because I really subscribe to the idea that, and I mean, you know, you had people like Karl Rove in the Bush era saying that America is an empire. And I largely, even though like that's their view of it, I like to take the view that a lot of the people I look up to also take, that America is functioning much like an empire in decline. So would you agree with that assessment? And if not, what's the historical moment that you think mirrors us the best? And what power dynamics happened in that society that make it similar?
I may have one or two.
Go ahead.
Unfortunately, I also concur it's definitely a power in decline. And I guess if we want to look at a bright thing, a bright moment out of all that is that it can be a wonderful spur of change in one way or another. But I will say it's weird because it's also a similar time periods. I would say the fall of the Roman Empire and just right after the fall of the, or not the fall, but the decline of the Zhou dynasty of China, with all the different philosophers coming out saying, hey, what about this? The empire seems to be not working. I mean, I think both of these are wonderful reflections. Both have very modern, well, quote-unquote modern philosophical ideals that we have seen today of various issues coming out of that time periods.
So let's start with the fall of Rome. Like, what led to that?
A few things. Okay. An empire that expanded way too far. An empire that greatly controlled way too much territory to the point that that you have governors running around with very little, with too much autonomy, too much say, too much wants, too much ability to exercise the use of their own power and not being regulated or checked by the emperor, or really anyone for that matter. So they were able to start collecting their own taxation, hence why we have a separation of the empire itself into the east and western portions, which if you want to compile that with corporations being unregulated and unchecked, go for that.
I mean, yeah, service fees and taxes, what's the difference?
Right. Exactly.
All right.
Yep.
And then what about the Zhou Dynasty? Let's get to that one too.
Oh, so the Zhou Dynasty, I would say that the fall of that, that comes into a lot of more issues. Some of the Chinese dynasties fall into issues, not just a mismanagement of the system, which there was, it's complete mismanagement of the Liu Zhou dynasty, because the emperor in charge decided that he could focus on only a couple aspects of life without, you know, focusing on others, namely the people. So because of that, and also natural disasters as it hits, individuals started to say on how to improve the dynasty. And obviously this is an era of Confucius and Taoism from Lao Tzu, Chuang Tzu, legalism comes about, all these different theories come about trying to discuss on just how to fix society, and none of them agreed. This will break down into the spring and autumn period and the warring states for obvious reasons. Obvious reasons being pertained to nobody getting along on that front.
Yeah, I think more pessimistic people.
Yes.
Oh, it's just like, I think the most pessimistic read people have of the current moment is that, much like that era, we're almost at each other's throats in the United States. I'm not sure to what extent I subscribe to that, but at least among the most politically engaged. I didn't like the term polarization at first, but I think we are at the point where we've reached such a spectacle that it's like two opposing teams at a sports game.
Oh yeah.
Where
I would agree.
And that's really, go ahead. Gabby, you had a point?
Yeah, I just want to say, I almost wonder though, how much of that has to do with, so really quick preface, I don't have an answer to your earlier question. I'm really glad Jeff took that one, because I'm more of a more recent history type of person. So not a lot of falling empires in the time that I'm a little more well-versed in. But I will say that I think that maybe instead of there being more polarization, I think there definitely is, but I almost feel like politics are now more accessible to a wider group of people, and there's more visibility to people that were not listened to before.
That's correct.
So instead of seeing something like, oh, this is the most polarizing space we've seen ever, it's more like, well, before we just weren't listening to or allowing there to be space for people who were being trodden on, and now they are being bolstered up at least a little bit more, and their concerns are in the forefront. Because if you were to ask me if I think we're in worse, like, in terms of this country's history, I mean, I would flag the Civil War as way worse of a period of time than, and not just because there was slavery, obviously because there was slavery, but also because, like, that was, I mean, if we're talking divisiveness,
I mean, we were literally seceding and like fighting a war on our soil. Yeah.
Like, there were literally states leaving the Union. And
right.
I mean, in terms of that, I mean, then if you just keep moving forward, I mean, the Civil Rights Movement is another big moment in history where people were literally, I mean, killing Black Americans in the street. I mean, like, and they were doing it beforehand, but they were doing it even more, I guess, brazenly, I suppose, in opposition to a movement that they saw. I think what we're seeing now is just a new resurgence of more visibility of groups, and the groups who are in power, namely white Americans, pushing back on that visibility, like they have done in iterations for years, generations, this entire country's history.
No, you're right, and I think I didn't get to fully qualify what I was going to say, but you actually, no, you gave me a better springboard to explain my point, is I think we're at the point now where it's like mentally we're just as divided as those points. But because of how spectacularized everything's gotten, I don't think anyone's really acting on it save for, you know, the political parties that they support. And even then, there's limited scopes for that. It's more of, especially like when we want to talk about the MAGA crowd, right? Like, I think they are the most performative type of conservative. You know what I mean? Or even in more liberal circles, I think there's been a big push towards representation, but we don't see the same energy put towards fighting back on inaction. So, I mean, we can even talk about, you know, just how much teeth pulling it took to get Biden elected and also to get him to accept certain points. But we're even at, you know, we were talking about trying to end qualified immunity, which could cut back at the power of the police. And that's not something that the administration is even seeming to take as seriously as they said they would, right? So at least, yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to, I definitely agree with that. And it made me start to think about this a little more too. I think, and maybe this is what you're getting at, maybe not.
Right.
In times before, it felt like there may have been more of a commitment by people in some level of power in government spaces to fight for certain areas, spaces. So if we go back on the example of the Civil War, you did have, I mean, the president and the whole party, like, fight actively fighting this war in order to do, I mean, I don't want to be too generous to the, even Lincoln and the other politicians during that time, because they did not have a charitable viewpoint on Black Americans. I mean, we all know that. However, you did see more of a commitment by people in power to at least try to enact some of that change or to pass legislation. Whereas now, like you said, it does, especially on the left side, just feels like a lot of like, gee, thanks. That's not what we need. Right. Like,
right. Like after our wave of protest, that was, I mean, for what it's worth, even if, you know, it wasn't the largest wave of unrest, we needed to do something. More people than you would expect were out. More people than you were out were saying, yes, I feel positively about this. But that being said, it's like all we really seem to get is like more Black people in commercials at best. You know what I mean?
And I think, too, if you come back to politicians on this, it feels like it's mirrored too. Like a bunch of especially Democrat politicians, right, you see them with their pronouns and their bios for things, and they and then, but at the same time, there is more anti-trans legislation that's been being passed right now than there has been. I mean, I would argue, I mean, at all. I mean, before people didn't focus specifically on it, but there is a specific concentrated attack in a lot of states, and it's like that's great that you're putting your pronouns or waving a flag around, but that doesn't actually change the lives of Americans right now. Like that's not what we need. I mean, yeah, I don't know what else to say about that, except that I think that what you're saying, that lack of action at the higher levels is really salient right now and is creating a lot more frustration and anger amongst people who are very ready for some movement forward, and they just feel like there keeps being blockades.
Yeah, and I'm just wondering, like, has this level of hopelessness that seems to really, at least in my read of things, seems to really paint things. Has there been a historical precedent for this level of helplessness? Based on your guys' understanding, I don't know.
I don't know. I feel like it depends on how you look at hopelessness, right? Because in terms of between each other, I think we're infighting quite a lot, and hopelessness in terms of like depending on our country to do things or to help individuals. But on the other hand, I'm thinking on like Cold War era, right? That was like a really fucked up period of time in American history. That isn't that like far reaching from where we are now. I mean, you have,
but it's treated like the ancient past.
Oh my God. Yeah. It literally, you had people turning their neighbors in for suspected communism.
Right.
I mean, that is some wildly, and
the labor movement was crushed. The civil rights movement was put under such intense scrutiny. And it was used to justify so many covert operations abroad. I mean,
one of the biggest things I think about, and this is just popping in my head right now, but there was a transcript in one of the classes I was in that one of my classmates was reading, and she was talking about, and it was during the Red Scare, and it flat out noted that if someone had homosexual tendencies, or they appeared to be homosexual, so this could, you know, be gender nonconforming in any way, shape, or form, any man who appeared a little more feminine, they were deemed as inherently untrustworthy. And because they were untrustworthy, that also meant they were communists. So if you are gay, you're untrustworthy. And if you are untrustworthy, you're probably a communist. And then that was enough justification to get these people put on trial and get locked up, right? Like, with very quick. So I, as much as I think this period of time is a very salient, very important spot that we need to be looking at, and I think historians are going to look back on and go, holy shit. I do think that somewhere like the Cold War, that to me feels very hopeless too. That feels very scary. Your neighbor could turn on you and try to get you turned into to the federal government. Like, that's, and then you think a bomb's going to drop on your head. Like, all the time they have kids hiding under desks with fun little songs explaining, like, oh, duck and cover in case there's a nuke. Like,
and just assuming the worst about the Soviets and the Cubans and any other, like, third world movement again. Yeah. Latin America, Indonesia, all of it is terrifying. Well, let's maybe put in this way. Was the Cold War the real, like, or just the end of World War II, really? Is that where we ended up with the modern condition, or is that more close to, like, maybe like Nixon to Carter is where, like, we can say, because yes, there was like the Volcker Shock and the real, like, push to neoliberal economics as, like, de facto how we run things in America. And then with Reagan, you had the rise of, like, finance, insurance, and real estate. But I think our overall acceptance of what's possible, especially in the United States and globally, maybe it was the Cold War that we just stopped believing in an alternative to the present that's less wasteful or more egalitarian or what have you.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, that's a big question. That, because I feel like when you think of the Cold War and you think of post-Cold War, I think you do have a period of time that is a lot less movement-based in the U.S. compared to pre. Cold War, I guess, extending, when I say Cold War, I mean extending into the early, or the late 80s, early 90s. Which encompasses a lot of time, which a lot of other movements happened as well. You had a lot of anti-war movements. You had, obviously, the civil rights movement happening all in that period of time. But since, when you look at, like, the 90s on to now, I don't think in our, at least my living memory, that aside from that, we've had so much civil unrest, we've had so much divisiveness amongst citizens, and maybe this is just the moment that might have kicked off that era that came between now and then, and this could be that next push, right? I don't know if that actually answers your question, but those are my thoughts.
That's fine. I didn't expect us to have answers. I just wanted to really address the topic, really. I guess, as always, let's go back to picking on liberals. That's my favorite thing to do on this show, right? With Biden winning in 2020, and with kind of the overall consensus in elite liberal media of, you know, the Bernie Sanders theory of change, that progressive theory is over, and it's time for a more old school Clinton style liberal to, you know, take the reins. But there's something about this style of governance, and I think we're getting back to something we were talking about earlier, right? About how there's a style of governance expressed by these folks that is almost devoid of understanding power at all. I think when it comes to even the culture war obsessed conservatives, right? They have a strategy to win elections and pack the courts and make sure that they gum up the legislative and let their allies in the judiciary pass all sorts of things, whether it's like disenfranchising people from their voting rights, whether it's doing things to harm LGBT people, doing things to, you know, stop reproductive services access, things like that. For what it's worth, the Republicans do have a theory of power that Democrats, for whatever reason, don't. And there's a fixation in liberal circles, especially, on adherence to norms and adherence to certain kinds of popular wisdom, at least to them, that really prevent them from fighting back. And I wonder if there's been something that happened that they don't even view this as a fight anymore. It's just a accumulation of how much virtue you can have. So I wonder what you guys make of this.
Yeah, I just want to say that I definitely agree that Republicans know how to play this game so much better, and they're open about it. They're clear. They're like, we're going to develop and gain power, and we're going to do this effectively, and they do it. I mean, the fact that they, even if you look at the quote unquote, and I use this, I guess this term liberally, red states, right?
Right.
They're constantly passing legislation that feels wild, right? It's like, what is this legislation? And there's no way it's going to pass through. And they do it to challenge and to continuously push that power envelope and kind of build this narrative and be able to push a little more. And it's acute understanding of how our system works and them taking advantage of it. And I don't think Democrats, they don't understand how it works. I think they fully understand how it works. It's just for some reason they're not willing to use it. And maybe it's because there's this mentality of, I mean, being quote unquote better than that, or thinking that that's, you know, beneath them and that they can intellectually win this out or something like that. Cause that also is the Democratic Party is accused of being this high-minded kind of ivory tower academic space where the common folk are not accepted, right? We elect smart people to run us and whatever it may be. And so maybe it comes from that, trying to uphold that virtue, that way of coming off of, we don't stoop to that level. We don't play those dirty games. We're better than that. But on the real way, it's majorly impacting people's lives because Republicans don't give a flying fuck. Like, right, they're doing what they need to do to make their constituents happy. And I hate that. I hate what their constituents want, but you know what? They're serving the people that elected them. And it sucks for me as someone who didn't elect them. Mm-hmm. However, I can't necessarily I can't say that it's an invalid thing to do. I can disagree with it, but I can't say it's invalid. If that makes sense. It's like, I don't want to endorse it, but I also need to acknowledge, like, this is the game. Like, this is how our system is set up. This is how our power structures function. And if you're going to get anything done, you need to do something with it. And Democrats don't want to do that.
Right. And I think
maybe it's that perceived sense of self that they want to uphold, or an image that they want to uphold. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Oh, go ahead, Jeff.
I 100% agree with that. And it's been bothering me for years. This kind of ivory tower of self-importance, self-righteousness is just an absolute pain, just nothing but pain for me. It's like comparing Athens to Sparta sometimes, or even more, which I found out when doing some little research for another side project, the ancient Chinese system of the Mohism, out of that same time period in the Zhou dynasty, called for, you know, scholarly thinking. They're all academics, and, you know, we should treat others, you know, as we treat ourselves, you know, golden rule and all. And they're making, like, weapons of war at the same time on the side, like no backbone against the system that commands them.
Yeah, and I think that was something we touched on in the last episode about the establishment. I was talking to Tyler and Josh about this, where, broadly speaking, the establishment, quote unquote, of the Democratic Party has the same goals of, you know, supporting foreign policy and the broader economic structure, right? But in this focus that, you know, especially the ivory tower liberals have on a very specific kind of social justice platform, very rarely has actual power been exercised to defend those people. You know what I mean? Like, for even the big win that was letting gay marriage happen in the United States, right? Obama got to claim that as a big fucking win, despite campaigning against it in the 08 primary, right? And the whole reason that it won was for all the fucking people that brought it to the Supreme Court. And then eventually, of course, the justices getting to vote on it. And that's the most arbitrary exercise of power, is how the Supreme Court gets that much power and that much influence, especially for life. But, it, you know, ultimately it comes down to those people fighting the case and winning it. But then anytime these victories get to happen, you know, Democrats get to basically, like, what's that Sailor Moon meme where it's like, I've saved the day, but you didn't even do anything. And then the guy just flies away. It's kind of like that, where it's just like, you know, we've always been there for minorities. And then it's like, cool, are you going to do anything to stop this level of voter disenfranchisement? Well, when they go low, we go high. And there's never any definition for what going high is. Because, it's not that I need to, you know, fight on Merrick Garland's behalf of all things, right? But I just remember, like, 2015 when this all went down, where it's like, basically, Obama could have just, and Senate Democrats could have just let it happen by Senate fiat. But because the Republicans refused to play ball, Obama just does this whole, like, well, I couldn't let it happen. I'm sorry, guys. I tried. I had a pencil and paper, but it didn't work. And there's just certain points where you get to say, fuck it. And if it's that whole idea of responsibility justifying power we talked about earlier, right? Where it's like, if you feel like you're doing the right thing, you should just, you know, do it and ask for forgiveness later at a point. Illegality be damned, but it wasn't illegal in this case. There was precedent to do it in another instance, even though it was for a federal judge. They could have justified it with the same precedent, right? I sincerely wonder how we're supposed to fight back against this with a, you know, quote unquote liberal front that says, no, no, we're the left. You got to stick up behind us. You got to prop us up every election cycle. And they can clearly point to just how bad the Republicans are and can even often describe the methods they use to deploy power, but then don't have a power-based theory to fight back. Do you get where I'm going with this?
Yeah, it's interesting because those structures are there, like you were saying, right? They're there, and it seems like they're just electing not to use them. And I bet someone doing their PhD in political science has looked at this, right?
Right.
But yeah, it's like there's only so many points where, whoops, sorry guys, there wasn't the straight cut way to do this, and so we couldn't do it for you. Because when you look at the stakes, especially when they predicate all of their election on, look at how horrible the other party is, look at all these rights they're taking away, we're gonna fight for your rights, we're gonna save you, we're gonna do these things. And that's kind of like their, especially with the culture war on the Republican side, like that's the whole thing with Democrats right now, is it a lot of people on the left vote, or even just minority groups tend to vote on the Democratic side because
who else are you going to vote for? That's the pitch. We're the only game in town. Where are you going to go? The Green Party?
Exactly. Yeah. And so, like, what are you going to do? Because there's also, obviously, I mean, maybe there's something to be said. We mentioned the Green Party. It's kind of like a throwaway joke. But, like, to be honest, like, I have friends who have wanted to vote third party and decided not to because they realized that the power structure isn't there. Mm-hmm. And it would essentially just mean that they could potentially get brutalized later down the road by this other major party that's getting elected. So it's interesting because Democrats do have power by virtue of being an established group that has been able to garner the support and garner this like recognition. But now that they're there, it's almost like that guy who shows up and it's like, now that I'm here, I don't know what to do. Like, I didn't think I'd get this far. And that, like, is how they feel.
Well, and that's, like, the main critique of, like, people like AOC and the squad, you know, as a whole, right? Is that at the end of the day, like, I'm as disappointed as anyone else that, like, they don't seem to put up as much of a fight against the base. But I think the real point that no one's hammering back is, like, to be fair, no one expected them to win. No one expected them to win re-election. And to top it off, there's no parliamentary strategy yet for how to work within that kind of system. Yes, we can definitely say that the three of them definitely have leverage, right? Because if Joe Manchin can hold shit up in the Senate, then yes, one person has enough influence to gum things up in the legislative. But, you know, to what end? Do you have enough to compromise with them? Do you have enough to like say, no, we can hold this up for you? It's tricky. And that's the dilemma for, I guess, all of us, be as progressives or more in the DSA camp or even further, is like, we're all asking for a deeper systemic reform or even change, right? To what extent? I'm not trying to hash that out, but I think we're all saying that, like, guys, this sucks. But I mean, what? We tried to run a challenge within the system with Bernie, and for what it's worth, even as far as we got, I think we're at the point where either people accept a certain existing framework of voting, but have no vision for dramatic change. It's just, hey, all you can do is vote and hope for the best. Or we're at the point where the vast majority of the country has just given up on participating.
Yeah, I want to jump in. I know.
No, you're fine.
But I was just thinking about this because there is a trend that happens with American politics specifically. If you look at presidencies, a lot of times when Democrats get elected into their positions, further back usually, it's usually during a time of like, wow, shit's really bad right now. And people want to see something shift. They want more social supports. They want things of that. They want those kind of supports that happen with Democrats usually, or I guess more left liberal types of politicians. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that the shift has happened at kind of a do nothing party for the sole fact that, FDR is who's coming to mind right now.
Right.
You would be hard pressed to find a president who pushed more and packed the courts more and had just like this very intense like control and like playing that system of power in a really like forefront way. Like he wasn't shy about the fact that he was doing that. And it's just interesting that his party, right, and we kind of view the current Democratic Party kind of as, in my opinion, as FDR's party. That's kind of when the party took on a lot of the values it has now. They've evolved, but he was kind of that base, the social programs, all of that kind of becoming a big part of the platform. And he was a pusher. He pushed people. But like legitimately. And so it's really interesting now that the party has become this kind of stuck in the mud, doesn't want to go any further or take any risks kind of space, where it's, I would argue, some of its beginnings were with him, and he was so
examining that New Deal coalition. Like, yes, for what it's worth, you know, there is the obvious critique that it didn't do enough for minorities than it could have. But also it's worth noting that it was only able to become that winning coalition because there still was a popular labor front, you know, that was skeptical of it. And they were at least able to get a pact where, hey, if you guys are on board with this and you agree not to strike during the war and shit, like, that helps. And it's also the fact that they were willing to reconcile with that more active front of labor that we had back then. Labor used to be a lot more active. People were a lot more organized, and you were able to extract concessions. And for what it's worth, FDR's advisors seem to be a little more open to that kind of thing, because I think he had a couple labor people on. I can't cite that fully, but I'm right. I know I'm right on this one, but again, it's like, there was still an understanding even at the FDR point of like, okay, we're the Democrats, we're not fully socialist, but there needs to be a popular front if we're going to fight back against the Republicans and all of this inequity. And they were able to correctly identify that the real cause of the Depression was this, you know, overarching oligarchic class, right? Now, they didn't share the anti-capitalist approach to that, but they had a theory for it. They had a theory to address it.
Well, I think it's just when you look at his presidency and you think about, like, I don't know, I feel like if you had FDR in a room with some of our more recent politicians now, he'd probably view them more as like almost conservative.
Right. Like, I don't think he would identify with this.
Because he was a mover, right? Like, and a lot of the people before him, so Herbert Hoover, which I think that man gets a lot more shit than he deserves because, anyway, but a lot of things that characterized a lot of Republicans or conservative platforms was like maintaining things. Like, it was very much like really that old conservative Republican idea of hands off, let's just let things run and do their thing, which is why a lot of times, in my opinion, Democrats would be voted in when shit hit the fan, because they were the party of, hey, let's you know, give things to people or do these things or whatever it might be. So give supports and whatever that would have looked like. And the Republicans weren't. And I think maybe this shift has come with Republicans becoming more this culture war piece, becoming a big part of their platforms and absorbing the evangelical Christians in the U.S. and becoming really this moralistic type of edge to their party might have pushed them to be more active and to take advantage of these pieces of power to push these agendas. Because before, their agenda was make government small, keep hands off, don't do anything with it, which you don't really need.
And they tried to justify that, because especially the real like crazy libertarians, in their analysis of power, it's like the minute it becomes competent, it's already going to oppress. You know what I mean? So even in the most reactionary circles, right wingers, there they go again, having a critique for power. But I think that is a lamentable aspect of, you know, the fall of the New Age the New Deal Democrat, and, you know, FDR's approach to this, where at least there was a liberal capitalist answer to, you know, hegemonic moneyed power in America. And with that being gone, you know, all there is really is the more social democratic or even socialist approach. And it this is a critical moment for some of that energy to come in, because we are in a record state of inequality in America. We are in a record state of wealth being produced at the top and incomes being stagnant for everyone else, pretty much. And just trying to critique that, it gets obscured behind so many other things. And whether you want to blame, you know, the cynical deployment of identity politics, whether you want to blame that on, you know, the lack of class consciousness, if you want to blame that on how much internalized self-worth we put in this country on wealth and, you know, the Protestant work ethic. It's a, you know, it is a cultural and, you know, almost a consciousness based understanding that needs to be changed at this point. Because at this point, like, everyone is, you know, feeling the pain more and more every day, but is blind to what's causing it. And I guess that's how I describe the moment we're in. It's almost like you're in a greenhouse and someone's gaslighting you inside it.
Ooh, you got the podcast. There it is.
Plugging my own podcast.
He's showed up. He's here.
So, yeah, I know this has been a haphazard episode, dear listener, but, you know, this is such a big topic, and I feel like, you know, at least in this series, I had to at least address this small point of power is something that's worth looking at least a little removed from everything else to make, you know, better sense of the situation that we're in. And just understanding that it's applied to ends that are good or bad, and that people hold it and people deploy it to ends, is more useful. Because I think a lot of us, me specifically, like, I came out of that liberal tradition of just assuming that, I mean, again, like, the West Wing was a poison for a lot of us, right? Where we just assumed, like, if you're just smart enough and you just project enough good ideas at them, they'll fold and they'll let you do it. But that's not the situation we live in. We're in a situation where, you know, there's always realpolitik is not a lens you apply to a situation. Realpolitik is the reality of how these things go down. There is a hard and soft power at play all the time. And if you're not paying attention to it, you're not getting useful results in your analysis.
Yeah, that's totally true. I think, oh gosh, this is such a big topic. I feel like anything we've talked about, and there are, even as I'm sitting here right now, there are a thousand different things that we didn't even
There's touch. A thousand things we didn't touch. There's a thousand things I gotta edit. You know what I mean? Yeah.
But like, it's honestly, it is such a complex, difficult topic to talk about and to think about. But I think, and if this is a closing thought, it might be a closing thought. But I think a useful exercise for me in terms of power and understanding power is trying to think about power dynamics and how they function kind of every day in my life. And I don't mean to sit down and think about age gaps all day and how there's a power dynamic there. That's not useful. Don't do that. But I do mean to.
And that's a favorite one on the internet, the age gap one. I'm just going
to
say that.
Like, I see it all the time, all the time. That's why there was a reason it was my example. But to sit and kind of think a little more about how power plays into conversations and things that occur, or even just basic things. A big one I like to pick on is, I think it's great that campaigns don't take corporate donations, but I also think that there is a level that becomes unrealistic because, in the US, money is power, and in order to gain political power, you need to have money. And it is so predicated on that to be realistically to fund something, you need to take some help. And this isn't endorsing it. I think it's a very broken system, but just understanding how power dynamics play into the system that we have and how it can further diminish value in certain spaces, or it can bolster up value, because we were very pessimistic in this episode. However, there are instances where power has been used for very good and productive means in plenty of ways. MLK might be a really good example for charismatic power, obviously. He's like the go-to. But yeah, just I challenge everybody to sit and think about power in their lives and think about it in everything they take, especially political conversations, and with a dose of like realism and how those dynamics actually play out. That was a lot to say, but be mindful, I guess.
Jeff, anything you want to?
Sure. Yeah. I would suppose. Just to kind of go off that, I would say be mindful of your local and state politics. I think that often gets swept under the rug in the excitement of, you know, the old saying of work locally, think global. Definitely applies here, I believe, and that. I feel like there's some great change, and I wish Democrats did it within their blue states, because I feel like you can really push for a lot. I think about what we've been able to do here in Michigan with the gerrymandering, legalization of marijuana, having a voting age, and being automatically to vote. I think this is such good things, and I feel like they are, the Democrats in the state of Michigan have taken a step back. I feel like the governor is worried about having too much flack in certain areas. And I'm just like, come on, you could just push and change the voting system so we can have a ranked choice voting system. And that made me so happy. Just take the power that you got, run with it, go in for what you're elected for, damn it.
Yeah, I mean, I think you guys really touched on that. I mean, you have to look at it ultimately as you understand it. I think my critique is a little harsher here, but it's to the point of, you know, if you want systemic and fundamental change, you can't tiptoe around it. You have to really think how you plan on doing this. Methods matter. Plans matter. Being part of something matters, right? So, you know, this isn't just something you can sit on the sidelines on and really comment on. This is, you know, where you need to consider, hey, I'm highly online and my politics are maybe, you know, further left than the DSA, but maybe I should just head out and see if it was worth, you know, just going to a meeting and maybe getting involved in some of that. Maybe it isn't for you. You know what I mean? But the system as it exists, unfortunately, allows for that. If you want to go outside of that, well, don't post about it, buddy.
Well, you might say, Adi, that with all these thoughts and power dynamic conversations and posting on social media, maybe you could use some of the tools that you that have been talked about in previous greenhouse gaslighting episodes in order to go out and enact actual change in your communities and your local politics.
That's true. That's true. And also, again, like, you don't have to agree with all of us here on everything we've said. We're just trying to have a meta discussion. If you found any of this useful, that's really all I'm trying to shoot for, right? I don't have the most consistent critique at times. I don't have the most consistent episode at times. I'm just having fun with my friends and, you know, maybe just hoping people consider something a little differently. So, any final plugs? Any final thoughts?
Thank you for having us on to talk about this.
My pleasure.
I love talking about
you so much.
I honestly can't do solo episodes, so like I need people on. I do better with the discussion, so trust me, like this is as much a part of everyone who comes on as it is me. So with that, I'm just going to get into my final closing plugs. We're finally on Twitch, guys. I'm playing Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild. Tomorrow on Thursday. Oh my god, no, I'm recording this on Wednesday and this is gonna be out on Saturday. My bad. So yeah, at the time of release, which should be Saturday morning Eastern time, I will be playing 4 to 7 on Sundays pretty much every week. And then I do a couple surprise ones every now and then, so just subscribe to us on Twitch. You'll get the update when I'm recording. And just make sure to follow us on the social medias. I'll put them in the doobly-doo. So with that, take care, guys. Take care, dear listener. And I'll see you again at the greenhouse soon.